We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Nicole Byer, helping you make those rooms flyer. Today's style tip, when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild! Like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Ooh, fierce! This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy and features real testimonials.
This was our first time trying therapy, and honestly, it was long overdue. Looking back, we just wish we had started sooner.
Regain's qualified therapists help couples when they can't get there on their own.
We thought it was intimacy issues, but Andrea helped us uncover a deeper root cause we hadn't even realized was there.
Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. Regain, powered by BetterHelp.
Looking to buy your dream home or rent that perfect apartment? With the Redfin app, you'll know the moment your next place hits the market. Set up your gotta-have-it wish list, and Redfin will send you real-time notifications for properties that match. And when you're ready to see it in person, scheduling a tour is just a tap away. Thinking about selling? Redfin can do that too. In fact, Redfin agents close twice as many deals as other agents, so they know how to get the best price for your home. And with a listing fee as low as 1%, Redfin charges half of what others often charge. So you could save big, like really big. Last year, Redfin saved home sellers $118 million. So whether you're buying, renting, or selling, Redfin's ready to help you win. Download the Redfin app and start searching today.
What disturbing story from your past can you share that still gives you chills? Story 1. Before my parents got divorced, my mom and I lived in Mexico with my dad and grandparents. I really have no idea how old the place was. From what I know, my grandpa's family had owned the land in that area of the city for generations. It used to be an old hacienda, and then they started splitting up the land among themselves. Some sold their share, and others stayed. So the house itself was kind of a combination of some very old buildings and some newer ones. Anyway, when I was about 5 years old, I started waking my mom up in the middle of the night, telling her there was a girl in my room who wouldn't let me sleep. My mom obviously chalked it up to nightmares, or maybe me watching a scary movie and dealing with the consequences. She let me sleep in their room, but she was weirded out by how often I kept doing it. She says I always seem more annoyed than scared, which made her doubt it was just bad dreams. For context, my mom is a huge skeptic and a very level-headed person. Ghosts weren't on her radar. My dad was the believer between the two, thanks to the things he'd seen and experienced growing up in that house. And he was the one insisting it wasn't just nightmares or scary movies. My parents had a pull-out couch in their bedroom and decided to let me sleep there until I was ready to go back to my room. But every time I tried to sleep in my room again, I always ended up back in theirs. My mom eventually asked me what the girl looked like, and I described her as being a little older than me, with long dark hair that covered her face and wearing a white dress. I said she would wake me up to play, and if I refused, she would turn violent or show me her face, which I described as rotting. My mom thought maybe my sister had made me watch The Ring, but I insisted the girl was real, and my sister denied ever letting me watch that movie. This went on until one night my mom woke up because she heard a girl's voice and assumed I was having a nightmare. She looked over to where I was sleeping and saw me still asleep until a shadow passed over me. Suddenly, I was being pulled up by the front of my shirt into a sitting position. I woke up screaming. My mom rushed toward me and my dad jumped up in a panic and ran to get my grandma. It all stopped pretty quickly after my grandma called in a priest and began leaving rosaries and icons of the Virgin Mary under my pillow. Very horror movie-esque, I know, but that was far from the last strange thing to happen in that house. For years, my grandpa has told us there's money buried under the house. It's a very common story in Mexico, and with it comes a superstition. Only the person being shown where the money is can claim it. Others say the one who finds it will die. My grandpa, apparently, is the one constantly being visited by the spirit of a woman telling him where the money is. My mom used to tease him, saying he'd lived long enough and should start thinking about his grandchildren's inheritance. My grandpa was always a good sport about my mom's joking, but what he described honestly sounded terrifying. He would say he was pulled out of bed in the middle of the night or would roll over and see something staring at him in the dark. He had many dreams about a woman offering to show him where the money was in exchange for three masses at a specific church. She would sometimes extend her hand, always covering it with her dress, which made my grandpa uneasy. At first, he agreed. He had my grandma go and request the first two masses, but when she went to request the third, the priest refused unless my grandpa came in person. For some reason, my grandpa didn't want to do that, so the third mass never happened. He also claimed he could sometimes see a glowing spot on the ground, but refused to say where exactly it was. Anytime I share these stories, people think I'm just retelling a horror movie plot, which I get. It does sound that way. But these are real things we experienced. I have a lot more stories from my cousins, my sister, my mom, and my dad, if anyone's ever interested in hearing more. These were just the bigger ones. Story 2. Oh man, I love telling this story to people because they never believe me. And the group I was with at the time all remember it the exact same way. I was 16, going on 17, during the summer of my junior year of high school. It was a Friday or Saturday night. You know, the usual. Living it up, being the bad kids, and having the time of our lives. We had some weed and needed somewhere to smoke it. So we went to the state forest nearby. There are multiple round gravel lots around the perimeter of the forest for hunters and hikers to park in when entering the woods. These parking lots are maybe big enough for 5 or 6 cars, not huge, and there's no real driveway or anything, just gravel semicircles off the main road. On the south side of this forest, there's an old abandoned church. It looks like a church, but rumor has it the people who used it were actually part of a satanic group. It's made quite a name for itself in paranormal circles and among locals. Apparently, shadows chase you off the property, and you can sometimes see lights when you drive by. I don't know. I never had any desire to go there myself. Anyway, that's the background on the location and setting. So we pull into this gravel lot. The park is technically closed from dusk to dawn. So yeah, we were trespassing, but we just needed somewhere to smoke. There were 5 of us in the truck. 2 guys up front and a guy and 2 girls in the back. We cracked the windows, lit up, listened to music, and hung out. After smoking, we were all feeling good, but not too high. We were all regular users, so we knew our limits, and we were fine. The kid in the back seat with us joked that it was too hot and cramped inside the truck, and if we didn't turn on the AC, he was going to climb into the bed of the truck. We all laughed. Nobody wanted the AC on, so we told him to go ahead. He climbed into the bed of the truck through the back window, and we continued chatting. Then suddenly, he popped his head back through the window and said, "Start the truck and get out of here now." The tone of his voice was bone-chilling, to be honest. But we were all like, "Nah, dude, you're just high. Chill out. We're in a parking lot. There's nobody here. We would have seen them pull up." He started climbing back into the truck, and he was visibly shaking. He said somebody was out there with us, and we needed to go. So we finally agreed, "All right, fine. John Doe is freaked out. We're out of weed anyway. Let's head over to his place." But then we all heard the sound of gravel, like footsteps coming toward the truck, and that lit a fire under us. We started the truck, turned on the headlights, and the parking lot was surrounded. We were in the middle of nowhere, parked in a state forest after dark, and the gravel lot was surrounded. I don't even know how many figures there were. It felt like every single gap in the trees was filled with a shadow, but they clearly weren't normal people. It was almost like something out of Men in Black. They looked like they were wearing black suits or cloaks. They all seemed like pale white men with bald heads, but their facial features were impossible to make out. Their bodies were too vague, too uniform. Honestly, I don't know if they were men at all. I don't even know if they were human, but they had pale skin and no hair. And they were everywhere. We peeled out of that parking lot, panicked and shaken, and talked about it the entire ride home. That was the end of the night for all of us. We split up and went our separate ways, trying to calm down. Everybody around here just says, "Oh yeah, that forest is haunted," like it's no big deal. But that night is scarred into my brain. Story 3. It was the summer of 2002 when the following took place. Since I was born, I was always subject to odd things happening in our household, but it wasn't until our family moved into a well-known apartment complex in Seymour that my life would be turned upside down. I would end up seeing something that would scar me and haunt my thoughts to this very day. Whatever was in that apartment, it was evil, and it seemed obsessed with torturing me more than anyone else in my family. Its presence grew stronger and stronger as time passed. I would explain to my parents and sister what I saw or heard, and it just felt like no one ever believed me, until odd things started happening to them too. One time I woke up around 4 a.m. The moon was so bright it lit the room my sister and I shared with a bluish glow. I had woken up to the sound of our parents' bedroom doorknob shaking violently down the hallway. My first instinct was to ask, "Everything okay, Dad?" No response. The doorknob stopped shaking. I instantly knew there was someone in the house. I leaned over to look into the hallway from my bed, and that's when I saw it. A 6 to 7 foot shadow was standing in the middle of the hallway. No one in my family is over 5 feet 7 inches. Panic and fear set in. I thought we were getting robbed. All I could think was, this is how I die. I slowly moved back into my bed, under the covers, and whispered my sister's name, trying to wake her up. She responded groggily, "What's up?" "I'm sleeping." I whispered, "Shh, there's someone in the hallway." Silence. She had fallen back asleep. I peeked back toward the hallway and saw the thing hiding along the side of the wall, like it was trying not to be seen. I could see its chest moving, like it was breathing heavily, and its fingers were disturbingly long. I had never felt such fear in my body. At that point, I wasn't just afraid for myself. I was afraid for my family. I didn't know what I was looking at. I woke my sister again, because of course, when you're terrified, you suddenly need to use the bathroom. She got up, half asleep, and followed me to wait outside the door. I was paralyzed with fear. As I washed my hands, I heard her walking back to the room. I quickly dried my hands, shut off the light, and started speed walking down the hallway. Then I heard it, running footsteps, growing louder and faster behind me. I ran.
This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy and features real testimonials.
This was our first time trying therapy, and honestly, it was long overdue. Looking back, we just wish we had started sooner.
Regain's qualified therapists help couples when they can't get there on their own.
We thought it was intimacy issues, but Andrea helped us uncover a deeper root cause we hadn't even realized was there.
Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. Regain, couples therapy that works.
What is dedication?
The thing that drives me every day as a dad is Dariana. We call him Day-Day for short. Every day he's hungry for something, whether it's attention, affection, knowledge. And there's this huge responsibility in making sure that when he's no longer under my wing, that he's a good person. I want him to be able to sit back one day and go, "We worked together, we did a good job."
That's dedication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Lowe's knows how to set off your July 4th with savings. Right now, buy one, get one free on select one coat coverage interior paint via Visa gift card rebate. Plus, get two select 2 or 2.5 quart red, white, and blue annuals for just $10. Hurry, these July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, excludes Alaska and Hawaii. More terms and restrictions apply. See Lowe's.com/rebates for more details.
I slammed our door shut, locked it, and jumped into bed. My sister asked if I was okay. She could tell I was scared. We tried to shake it off. Maybe we were just half asleep. Then suddenly, we both heard the door violently shaking, like something was trying to get in and wouldn't stop. The door stopped. Silence filled the room. I asked my sister, "Did you hear that?" She replied in a nervous tone, "Yeah." I sprinted across the room and pounded the wall with my fists, screaming for help. I heard my dad get up and run toward our door, knocking and asking if everything was all right. We explained what had happened, and he searched the apartment. Every door and window was locked from the inside. No sign of anyone. To this day, the image of what I saw still haunts me. That place was evil. It changed our family for the worse. The feeling of dread and depression filled the walls of that apartment like nothing we'd ever known. I still don't know what I saw that night, but I'm grateful it never happened again. Story 4. I've had 3 very definitive and terrifying experiences. One with a demon in California, one with some kind of skinwalker in Oregon, and one with a witch in Utah. The skinwalker one was the most threatening and violent, so I'll just tell that one. In 2012, my buddy and I were driving from LA to Portland. We had taken a long scenic route and were getting tired of it, so we decided to cut across some mountains to get back to the major freeway heading west. We checked the map and found a route that would take about 5 hours. The sun set late that time of year, so it was just starting to go down as we turned onto this two-lane road into the forest. About an hour in, everything seemed normal, but something felt off. We hadn't passed a single other car. The forest around us was pitch black, the moon hadn't come up yet, and we had no cell service on either of our phones. We came around a corner, and there was a huge buck standing in the middle of the road. We were going about 65 miles per hour and had to swerve to avoid it. It didn't budge. We were shaken and realized how deep in the woods we were. Definitely not a place we wanted to get stuck. We slowed down. A few minutes later, another deer jumped toward the car, then another just a bit further down. It was like we were dodging deer on a pitch-black winding road, and our eyes started to strain from tunnel vision. Finally, the moon came out, and we got a bit of relief, thinking maybe we were almost out. Through the trees, we saw moonlight reflecting off water, some kind of lake, and for a moment, it felt like we were back on track. Then we saw it. A light set up on the road, and next to it, a woman slumped in a folding chair beside a sign that read, "Road Closed," just sitting there in the middle of the road. I slowed down, rolled down the window, and asked, "Is the road actually closed?" There weren't any signs till now. She said, "Road's shut down till 6 a.m. Turn around or just sleep here if you want." And she kept sitting there. There were no other cars, no shelter, nothing, just her. We were exhausted and decided we'd just pull back a little way, away from her, and try to sleep. We parked next to the lake, turned everything off, and tried to rest. It was chokingly silent. Neither of us was sleeping. We were both pretending. Then suddenly, inside the car, right between us, we heard a little girl scream, a blood-curdling scream. I immediately turned on the car and hit the gas. My friend was panicking, saying, "I'm sorry. Whatever happened to you, we don't have anything to do with that." He was having a breakdown. As he closed his eyes and started praying, I caught something out of the corner of my eye. Something big and white, rushing silently down from the forest toward the car. I was terrified, gripping the wheel, going 60 with the pedal to the floor. This tall, thin, white creature was keeping pace right next to my window for about 4 seconds. I didn't dare look directly at it. I knew if I did, I would die. I rounded a bend, and it peeled off into the forest. Then lightning cracked above us. It started to drizzle. A moment later, we came across something on the road. A deer carcass, just destroyed. Then another. Ripped in half. Steam was rising from its rib cage like it had just happened. By this point, I think we were both hysterical. It started pouring rain, thunder, lightning. It felt like the forest was closing in on us. Finally, in the distance, we saw the intersection where we'd first turned off the main road. We raced toward it like it was the finish line. And the second we reached the stop sign, everything stopped. No more rain, no lightning, no thunder. We looked at each other and just laughed. Not because it was funny, but because we didn't know what else to do. Then my phone rang. It was around 3 a.m. It was my mom. I picked up, about to tell her what had happened. But she cut me off, furious. She said, "Who the hell was that? Who was that woman screaming at me? Your phone called me in the middle of the night and I answered, and some horrible woman was just screaming at me. I tried calling back and it was off. And now you finally pick up?" We drove to the nearest hotel. I slept with a small crossbow in my hand. Years later, I started reading about skinwalkers, people painted white, running beside cars, appearing in the woods. What I saw matched the descriptions exactly. I think about it all the time. Story 5. It was 1988. I was staying over at my boyfriend's family's house. My boyfriend worked nights and usually got home around 2 a.m. At 1:30 a.m., I woke up. I was paralyzed and felt a tremendous weight on my chest. I couldn't breathe or move. My nose and mouth couldn't get any air. Even if I could, I wouldn't have been able to get it into my lungs. I swear I was fully awake. Although it was dark and the atmosphere seemed foggy, I was conscious. I looked at the clock and noted the time. I tried to focus on the picture of Jesus on the wall. I couldn't talk, scream, or even whimper. There were 4 other people in the house, but I couldn't call to them. Then the panic started, and every microsecond felt like forever. I needed air. I heard whispers, but I couldn't make out any words. All of a sudden, headlights filled the room. My boyfriend had come home. The pressure lifted, and I could breathe again. Just like that, it was over. The moment he came in the door, I started crying out of sheer fear. He said that when he pulled up, the floodlights in the backyard came on, and he saw a shadow running. Since the internet became a thing, I've searched for a logical explanation, but sleep disorder just doesn't fit. It was a very real and memorable experience, and it never happened again. That was a long time ago. Although the memory didn't scar me for life, I now go to bed with three dogs, and I've been a light sleeper ever since. Story 6. I got attacked by something in my barracks room. This actually just happened to me about 15 minutes ago. I'm currently in my car in the parking lot outside my barracks, typing this now. I was in my room getting ready for the week when the closet light flickered. I didn't think anything of it, just figured it was the usual army barracks stuff. I continued hanging up laundry and cleaning up, and suddenly all my lights went out. That spooked me a little. I went to turn them back on, and they worked fine. But just after I turned on my main light, it felt like someone grabbed my shoulder and pulled me. That's when I really started to panic. I felt sick and lightheaded. I drank some water and sat in my chair, trying to process what had just happened. I kept feeling nauseous for a good 30 minutes, and I finally decided to lay down. After lying there for a bit, my whiteboard, hanging on the wall, somehow unhooked itself and fell. I immediately got up, threw on a sweatshirt and shoes, and tried to leave. I couldn't find my keys. I started to panic even more, and suddenly I felt a burning pain on my abdomen. I ignored it and focused on getting out of the room. I eventually found my keys and made it to the parking lot. As I was walking to my car, the burning pain returned, so intense I almost stopped, but I pushed through. Now in the car, I lifted up my sweatshirt to see what it was. I have three scratch marks right where I felt the burning. My heart dropped. I felt like crying. I have no idea what just happened. I don't know who I can talk to about this, so I figured this subreddit was my best bet. I don't know much about this kind of thing. I've never really believed in ghosts, but I never fully denied them either. I'm not religious at all. I never thought anything like this could actually happen, and I'm terrified. If you know anything, please let me know. Thank you in advance. Story 7. Throwaway account because my fiancé knows my real one, and I don't want him to see this. He already thinks I'm losing it. This is going to be a bit long, but please bear with me. Last August, we began relocating to another city. My fiancé had been offered a position at a company he'd wanted to work at since graduating. I was okay with the move because I'm a private tutor at a small institute, and I was lucky enough to transfer to their other branch. My fiancé moved in first in August. I followed in September. He found a house that was new, a little outside the city, and cheaper. We were trying to save since we agreed to get married after paying off our debts, his credit cards, and my student loans. He mentioned the house had electrical problems at first, but he called the realtor and supposedly had it checked out. We didn't talk about it again. When I moved in fully in September, things seemed fine. On September 28th, we were supposed to head to my fiancé's sister's birthday. He left first, and I stayed because of work. I got home around midnight. All the lights were on, all the TVs were on, and even his desktop was running. I texted him, and he said he hadn't left anything on. The door was locked, the alarm hadn't gone off, and there was no sign of anyone entering. I let it go. That night, I put my phone next to me on the charger and set multiple alarms. The next morning, I woke up, and the phone was gone. Panic set in. I searched everywhere. Nothing. I used my laptop to check the time. It was 11 a.m. I messaged my fiancé on Facebook and told him what happened. He wasn't mad, just annoyed, and probably assumed I was making an excuse. He called my phone. No noise. No ringtone. I never put my phone on silent when he's out of town. Later, when I ordered takeout and sat down to eat, I left to grab a napkin. I heard my ringtone and found my phone inside the McDonald's bag. It had 100% battery. No notifications, no missed calls, nothing. I told my fiancé, and he got even more annoyed, saying I needed rest. I called my sister, but she didn't answer. I was genuinely freaking out and decided to sleep in the living room with all the lights on. Nothing else happened for about 2 months. On my birthday in November, I had to work, but my fiancé cooked for me. We had dinner, celebrated, and then went to bed. I heard his phone ringing from the kitchen, so I got up to get it, but it wasn't there. The ringing stopped, and both doors of the fridge were wide open. The fridge has an auto-close feature unless you open it fully and put in the stopper. The alarm beeping from being left open too long wasn't going off, which meant it had just been opened. I called for my fiancé. He ran in, thinking something was wrong. I told him what happened, and he said, "My phone is on silent. It's charging next to me. You must have been dreaming. You're just tired. and I believed him. Logic made sense. I moved on. The TV continued to turn on by itself occasionally. My fiancé said it must be wiring. 2 days ago, I came home early, sore from the gym. I decided to take a hot bath. I filled the tub with hot water, so hot I left the bathroom door open and cracked a window. Just as I was about to get in, I got a package delivery. I signed for it and came back. No more than 3 minutes later, the water was ice cold, not just cold, icy. When I touched it, the shock made me slip and fall into the tub. Now I have a bruise on my hip. I didn't tell my fiancé because he'll just say I'm tired again. But I swear, it was hot. I don't know what's happening. I've never experienced anything like this. And I've never believed in it either. It doesn't make sense, but it's real. The house is brand new. The previous owners were an elderly couple. It had no history. I don't know who to talk to. I don't even know why I'm writing this here. Maybe hoping someone has answers or a solution, anything. Story 8. This was in Costa Mesa, California, and it happened just this past November. I was homeless at the time and under immense stress. I've had a dozen or so very strange things happen in my life, but this one was truly upsetting. I was walking my usual route around the community college I still attend. I had recently quit my job and moved out of a rented room. I'm not the most social person. I've struggled with depression and feeling like the world weighs heavier on me than most. I'm sharing that because I know how this may sound, but I swear to my creator this is 100% true. I approached a crosswalk and saw a woman about 30 yards away, walking toward a grocery bag lying on the sidewalk. She was already carrying two bags. I offered to help. She was short, maybe 5 feet tall, 60 to 70 years old, Asian, and generally unkempt. She said sure with a thick accent and told me she was going across the street, the same way I was going. She handed me a bag and I insisted on taking the second one too. We left the third bag on the sidewalk to pick up. At first, the bag seemed fine, heavy but manageable. As we walked to the corner, the weight of the bag seemed to double. At the crosswalk, she started rapidly pressing the button like she was in a panic. By the time the signal changed, the bags felt like they were 80 to 100 pounds each. I'm 6 feet one and in good shape, and I sincerely didn't think I could make it across. She looked at me with this wide, creepy smile and said, "Too heavy." I was terrified. I barely made it across and dropped the bags on the sidewalk. She walked up with half steps, both hands on her one bag, still smiling. "Too heavy. You stop here or keep going?" she asked. I said, nearly crying, "I'm sorry, I can't go any further." She smiled even wider. "Okay." I ran back across the street in fear. When I looked back, she was hoisting each bag under her chin and walking them, three or four steps at a time, into the Fairview Developmental Center, a community for the mentally disabled. I wept. I was terrified. I still am. I think about that moment all the time, and I still don't understand what happened. Story 9. I've worked as a correctional officer for a long time. I've worked at facilities in Texas and in Michigan. The oldest prison I've ever worked at just recently started to close in Michigan, and it got me thinking about all the paranormal experiences I've had there and in other prisons I've worked at. I'd like to share with you some of the more notable encounters I've had while working in these facilities. First off, I'd like to say that I never really believed in ghosts before I started working as a correctional officer. I started off working in Texas at an intake facility. I worked night shifts, 12 hours from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. The first experience I ever had was while working on a lower security housing unit. After finishing a round, I was chatting with my partner when I heard a loud banging sound. It was about 3 a.m. at this point. No prisoners should have been out of their bunks. I asked my partner if they knew what the banging was. They, being an older officer, told me bluntly that the unit we were working in was haunted. They said the sound was coming from one of the quiet cells in a hallway not directly visible from the officer's station, and that a prisoner had died in one. Allegedly, the prisoner died because the officers working there at the time gave him a sack lunch, and he choked on the food and died. I didn't believe the unit was haunted, so I decided to go look at this door. The banging got louder as I got closer. The door itself was visibly shaking, as if someone was pounding on it. There was nothing that could have caused it. I was at a loss for words. Later that night, I checked the door again and saw a steamed-up handprint on the glass of the door's window. Another experience I had was at the same facility, but in a different housing unit. It was around 1 or 2 a.m., and I was sitting inside the officer station, watching the cameras and talking to my partner. I looked at one of the cameras and clearly saw a prisoner sitting at a table in the day room. I turned my head to look at the actual day room, and no one was there. I asked my partner to check it out because no one was supposed to be out of bed. I rolled back the camera footage to see where the prisoner might have gone. On the video, the prisoner slowly faded away and vanished. My partner came back, and we both watched the footage over and over again. Later that same night, I noticed a wet floor sign that had been left out. I returned it to the porter closet. I got back to the officer station and looked again. There was the wet floor sign out again. I asked my partner if they were playing a prank on me, but they denied touching it. I went back, put it in the closet, and locked the door. I returned, and there it was again, sitting right in the open. My partner and I started watching it. The sign began to tip over slowly, two of its legs lifting off the ground. Then it slammed itself to the floor and slid quickly up the hallway before returning to the spot in front of the closet door. It then stopped moving. My partner and I refused to leave the officer station for the rest of the night because we were terrified. Another notable event happened in Texas while I was working in an ADSEG unit, a high security area for inmates who frequently get into fights or cause problems. One night, a prisoner was housed in one of our close observation cells, typically used for those threatening self-harm. Sometimes inmates fake this during the summer to get into the cooler cells near AC vents. This inmate told me he was doing just that and didn't want to cause trouble. Later that night, my partner and I saw a shadow move across the floor on camera. It moved to the close observation cell and disappeared under the door. I did a round to check on the inmate. He was pacing. I asked if he was okay, and he told me something felt wrong and that he was hearing voices. I tried to calm him down, and eventually he lay down on the bed. Later, my partner called for assistance because the inmate had bitten into the skin of his own wrists, was bleeding, and allegedly began speaking in tongues while holding his arms above his head. When I started working at prisons in Michigan, I was assigned to one that was built back in 1877, one of the oldest still operating prisons in the U.S. There were so many small experiences I had there, slamming doors, strange voices, and unexplained chills. The first really memorable experience happened around Christmas during third shift. I was working the oldest unit in the facility. Usually we didn't house inmates there, but due to the COVID-19 pandemic, it had been reopened. I didn't have a partner that night because we were short-staffed. One of the other officers set up a TV for me to keep me entertained since I'd be isolated far from other units. I did rounds throughout the night and watched TV in between. Suddenly, I heard banging from a door that led to a hallway connected to an even older, condemned part of the prison. I opened the door and looked down the hall. A cold breeze hit me, and my arm hairs stood on end. Thoroughly creeped out, I shut the door and returned to my seat. As I started watching TV again, the channels began flipping rapidly, then landed on static. I ended up getting moved to another unit because I was so scared. One night on third shift, my coworker and I had some free time, so we decided to explore the prison. We went through the underground tunnels, the old barns, the empty gun towers. Eventually, we went to the condemned part of the prison I had experienced earlier. There was a big metal gate halfway down the hallway that had to be unlocked with a large skeleton key. We entered the old segregation area. It was pitch black, so we used flashlights. The energy there was awful. It filled me with dread. I told my coworker I wanted to head back. As we were walking, his flashlight suddenly died. We barely made it to the hallway with the gate. Then we heard something running behind us. We started running too. My coworker fumbled with the key, and we could hear the footsteps getting closer. We finally got the gate open and sprinted out. Later, I saw that my coworker had red claw marks all over his arms. Story 10. Okay, so this was around 7 or 8 years ago. We were getting insulation for our very small attic space, which was directly connected to my room with a door. We had a small house. We had never opened this area since we moved in. I was sitting on my bed when my parents opened the door, and immediately everything went wrong. My lights blew out. Three bulbs in one lamp and one in a separate lamp plugged into a different surge protector all went out at once. I'm pretty sure it wasn't just a freak electrical coincidence. My parents stopped what they were doing and went downstairs to check the breakers. I was still sitting on my bed, and the only light coming in was from the hallway. My door was cracked open, just enough to light maybe a quarter of the room. That's when I heard a growling sound coming from the attic. It scared the life out of me because I thought there might be a raccoon or something up there. I didn't move, I didn't want to spook it. The growling continued for a few minutes. Then I heard ridiculously loud footsteps, like someone stomping with all their strength on the attic floor. And then I saw it. A shadow, maybe 7 or 8 feet tall, walked out of the doorway. It was mostly defined but not detailed, and it kept making those thunderous footstep sounds. It raised a hand and made a gesture that looked like a come with me wave. Then it walked back through the attic door. I waited a few seconds after it disappeared, then shut the attic door immediately, and my lights came back on. This all happened in the span of maybe 10 minutes. When my parents came back upstairs, I told them what happened, but they said they didn't hear a thing. I still have no clue what happened to this day. I don't think I'm schizophrenic or anything, and I wasn't asleep, so it's not like this was sleep paralysis. I'm still skeptical about paranormal stuff, even after this, because the whole event just seems so much like something out of a horror movie. It's hard to believe it was real. Story 11. This happened when I was in high school. I was at my friend's apartment, and she had a neighbor upstairs who was a few years younger than us. We hung out with her sometimes when I visited. On this particular day, the neighbor mentioned she had a Ouija board and asked if we wanted to use it. We agreed. I personally didn't believe Ouija boards were anything more than a myth. We went into the garage area of the building and put our fingers on the planchette. For the first few hours, nothing really happened. Eventually, we got movement on the board and started asking questions to the spirit, who began answering. Someone asked if the spirit was trying to talk to any of us specifically, and it spelled out my name. I thought one of them was messing with me. So I asked the spirit's name. It spelled out my grandmother's name, who had died 6 months before this. I got uncomfortable because my grandmother's name is in another language, and I had never told my friends what it was, nor would they have known how to spell it. I asked what she wanted. It started to spell URGR, and then the planchette started moving erratically, circling off the board and not making sense. Then it suddenly spelled out "You are great." This part will be important later. I brushed it off, thinking we were just moving the planchette weirdly, and we said goodbye. A few days later, my grandfather, my grandmother's husband, passed away suddenly. It was completely unexpected. He was healthy and looking forward to Christmas. While sitting at his funeral, I thought about the Ouija board and realized something. When the board initially spelled URGR and then scrambled around, maybe it was trying to spell grandfather. But the board started going erratic, like something stopped it from finishing the word, like it was trying to warn me. The next few months were awful. I started blaming myself, convinced that I had caused my grandfather's death by using the board. I became suicidal. The thoughts I had didn't feel like my own. Dark, intrusive, like something else was putting them there. I constantly felt watched, like something was near me. I even remembered being in the bathroom the night we used the board, under a light fixture, when I suddenly got a strange feeling and stepped away. Seconds later, the light shattered. If I hadn't moved, I could have been seriously injured. Eventually, I confessed to my mom about using the board. The moment I did, I felt a huge weight lift. The dark thoughts started to fade. I began to feel like myself again, but I still wondered, was that really my grandmother, or was something pretending to be her? Fast forward a few months, I was at an overnight school event. Another friend brought a Ouija board, and I decided to use it again to see if I could get any answers. At one point, the board said it wanted to talk to me specifically. We asked who it was. It began to spell D-E-V. We panicked, but then it spelled a word I didn't recognize. My friend looked it up later and told me it meant devil in another language. That's when I was convinced whatever contacted me the first time wasn't my grandmother. It warned me about my grandfather just enough to ensure I'd feel guilty when he passed, which made me more vulnerable. That guilt gave it influence, even control. I still don't know if everything really happened the way I remember it, but it's the only explanation that makes sense to me. Story 12. About 7 years ago, I received an invitation to attend my cousin's dinner party. I had never met this cousin before and had only spoken to him over the phone. I was surprised that his family suddenly invited me after all these years. The invitation included an unfamiliar address that my GPS couldn't locate. I ended up using a physical map and pinned the location manually. As I drove, I began to realize how far I was venturing from civilization. Just endless trees and farms. Where the hell am I going? I muttered to myself. Eventually, I found an address that seemed close to what I had pinned. As I approached the house, I noticed how dull and eerie it looked. It was completely covered in leaves and branches. This can't be it, I thought. As soon as I entered the rocky driveway, a man and woman, my supposed aunt and uncle, came out to greet me. They seemed excited and welcoming. Once inside, I asked where my cousin was. They immediately replied, "He went to run a few errands. He should be back later." We spent a couple of hours talking about my mom and the rest of the family. My aunt made a delicious homemade pot roast that I finished within minutes. After dinner, we played a lively game of Uno. It was surprisingly fun and competitive. But as it grew dark, there was still no sign of my cousin. Regardless, I needed to leave. It was almost nightfall, and I didn't want to get lost driving back from this remote place. Since my GPS still wasn't working, I asked them for the most efficient way back to the highway. They exchanged puzzled looks. "I thought you were staying the night," they asked. I explained that I couldn't. I had work the next day and couldn't afford to miss it. "It's much better if you leave tomorrow morning. Trust me, you'll get lost," they said. I tried to brush it off and assured them I was a skilled navigator. "I could find my way out of the Sahara Desert," I joked. Looking agitated, they strongly insisted that I stay the night for my own safety. At this point, I was getting irritated. I sighed and said, "Fine, I'll stay the night, but I have to get up early for work." Suddenly, they both seemed oddly excited that I had agreed to stay. As soon as they went to fetch bedsheets and pillows, I bolted. I ran out the front door, jumped in my car, and backed out of the driveway as fast as I could. It took some time, but I eventually found my way out of that depressing, isolated area. I got home about an hour later than expected. It was 11 p.m., and I didn't want to wake my parents. I climbed the fence and entered through the back door, only to find the kitchen lights on. As I stepped in, I saw my mom sitting there, looking impatient. "Where were you?" she asked. "I was at Aunt Deborah's." "You knew this," I replied. "Then why did she call saying you never arrived?" To this day, I have no idea who I actually visited. Story 13. About a year ago, it was my only son's 18th birthday. It was a small get-together with just a few guests, some close relatives, and a few of his friends. I wish I could have planned something bigger. "You only turn 18 once." That's what the older family members kept saying. But truth be told, I was never much of a big birthday guy. My side of the family never cared much for celebrations. My late wife Mary, though, she was the go-to when it came to throwing parties. She had been a wedding planner for many years, so she really knew how to organize a good time. She passed away when Jake was only 10. Feels like just yesterday we were planning our lives together. She was on her way home from the office when a drunk driver hit her head-on. I remember sitting in that hospital waiting room. An officer came out and explained the collision. Not long after, the doctors told me she had suffered numerous internal injuries. They couldn't stop the bleeding. I like to believe she went to some afterlife and is looking down on us from above, though I'm not sure if I truly believe in such things. Still, I wanted Jake to believe that's where his mother went. I got Jake a new fishing rod, and I had planned a week-long fishing trip just for the two of us. He loved fishing. When he was younger, he always begged me to take him. As he got older, he was down at the pier every day. If he wasn't in school, he was fishing. During the summers, he'd be out from dawn till dusk. One night, he didn't come home until midnight. My brother Dave had bought him a new reel, and Jake had been testing it out. Dave and I were just like Jake when we were young. Fishing fool, and that's what our parents used to call us. Dave moved inland for work a few years before Jake was born, so we hadn't fished together in a long time. I remember calling Dave just hours after Jake was born to say, "You've been replaced as my fishing partner." We both laughed. It was around 9 p.m. when most of the guests had left. After walking Dave out and having a quick smoke, I came back inside and found Jake admiring his new fishing gear. "Hey," I said with a grin, "we gotta head out early tomorrow morning, so don't stay up too late." He nodded and said he wouldn't, but I knew better. Morning came fast. I woke up extra early to make sure we had everything we needed: food, drinks, tackle, and gear. After finishing up with the truck, I went upstairs to wake Jake. I knocked and heard a loud, enthusiastic, "Come in!" He was already packed and wide awake. "Come downstairs," I said. "We'll grab some breakfast on the way. I want to be on the water before noon." He didn't say much, just grabbed his bag and followed me. The drive was about 3 hours, and we pulled up to the dock around 10:30 a.m. My boat was an old wooden fishing vessel I had inherited from my father. The red paint was peeling, and it looked every bit its age. It had a small captain's cabin with two bunks, a table, and a couple of chairs. Perfect for a week, I said to Jake, tossing my bag on the bottom bunk. Why do you get the bottom bunk? He teased. Because I'm old. All the creaks you're hearing aren't just coming from the boat, I joked. We both laughed. After settling in, I locked the truck and we set off. By noon, we had our hooks in the water. Mary could never get into fishing like we did. She used to say, I can't just sit around waiting for something that might not happen. After just a few minutes, Jake shouted, Fish on! He yanked back hard. Whatever he had on the line was strong, but then suddenly the line snapped and flung him backward. You all right? I asked. Yeah, I'm good, he said with a thumbs up. You sure? How's your head? It's fine, just bumped it. If you need a bandage, the first aid kit's inside. I'm good, he repeated. That day came and went. We turned in early. The next morning we were back at it. We caught some too big, some too small, but managed to keep a few. That night, Jake and I shared a couple beers while frying up our catch. Fried fish and grits, my favorite. It became his, too. Mary couldn't stand grits. She thought we were crazy. After dinner, we cleaned up and turned in. Later that night, I woke up to Jake yelling for me. As my feet hit the floor, they were soaked. What the hell? I murmured. Jake looked terrified. What are we going to do? He asked, trembling. I grabbed his hand, got my bearings, and reached for the flashlight. The time read 1:20 a.m. I climbed onto the deck. One of the hull boards had given way, and water was pouring in fast. I knew right then we weren't going to make it back before the boat sank. I calmed Jake down and searched for the life raft. Damn, I muttered. I can't find the raft. We were going to have to swim. I grabbed whatever gear we could salvage, and we jumped into the water. It's going to be all right, son, I said. I knew he was scared of the water at night. We just need to make it to shore. We paddled away from the wreck so we wouldn't be pulled under. 2 hours into our swim, Jake started panicking again. Dad, he whispered, I think I heard something. I looked around, but it was pitch dark. Just keep swimming, Jake. Deep breaths. We're going to be okay. Could it be a shark? It's nothing, I said, trying to keep him calm. About 30 minutes later, something slammed into us. I was knocked back. When I processed what had happened, I started screaming Jake's name. There was silence. Then he resurfaced with a scream that tore through the night. It's eating me, Dad. Please make it stop. It hurts. There's no amount of alcohol that can erase that scream from my memory. I swam toward him, heart pounding. As I reached him, I could feel something large, rough, sandpaper-like skin. It was a shark. I heard the crunching of his bones. His screams got worse with every bite. I punched at the thing, over and over, but it didn't stop. I smelled the iron from his blood mixing with the salt water. Then he let out one final scream before being dragged under. I screamed for him. I pleaded with whatever was out there to take me instead. But it didn't. Eventually, after hours floating in the surf, I found my way back to shore. The sun was just rising. I looked down at my shirt, stained red. I dropped to my knees and wept. I couldn't eat for weeks. I couldn't even make a phone call to tell anyone what happened. When I finally told my brother, he came and stayed with me for a few months. It's been a year now, but the grief, the screams, and the memories are still alive. I don't know how to move forward. Most days, I just drink and smoke to get by. If there's one thing I hope people take from this, it's to never take time with your loved ones for granted. You never know when it'll be the last moment you get. Story 14. The Mariani family has lived in this country for generations. We were a loud and proud bunch from the boot. Everyone always stereotypes Italian immigrants as brutish thugs or that we're all connected. Unfortunately, my family liked to live up to those stereotypes. From the moment we stepped off the boat, it seemed like we were fine-tuned for trouble. My great-grandfather got his start as a bootlegger, right at the tail end of Prohibition. Vincenzo, the Wall Mariani, my grandfather, was a respected capo in one of the five families. That brings us to my father, Frank Sr., who never really had the temperament or fortitude for the life, a fact that Papa Vincenzo respected, all things considered. Still back then, he was expected to keep up appearances, to make it seem like he was grooming an heir. So he and Papa came to an understanding. Dad would make small collections and drive some friends around on errands. It would all work out, as long as he didn't ask any questions. Dad wasn't stunted. He had some inkling about what was happening on those drives. This went on for a few years until it ended somewhat abruptly. My father moved away and distanced himself from that part of the family. We rarely saw the black sheep Mariani unless it was for a wedding or a funeral. The last time I saw Papa Vincenzo was just a few weeks ago at my cousin Vincent's funeral. He went around the room shaking hands, offering condolences, chatting with anyone who would indulge him. He and Dad exchanged few words, and it was then I decided I needed to get the full story behind their fallout. That night, I cornered him in the kitchen and asked why he was so cold to his own father. I laid on the guilt pretty heavy, but he just scoffed. When I was your age, if I talked to my father like that, they'd have found me in 7 different dumpsters, he said. That probably wasn't too far from the truth. I urged him to continue, and he got quiet, lost in thought. Finally, he spoke up. Frank, did I ever tell you about some of the jobs I did for my old man? There was a grave tone in his voice. He went on to tell me stories from his time in North Jersey. They fascinated me. Some of them sounded so outlandish I had to stop myself from interrupting. He told me about his first collection run. He didn't have his own set of wheels yet, and Papa Vincenzo loved his son very much, but not enough to let him drive his 1958 Cadillac. So he showed up at the brownstone of Pauly Caruso, hat in hand, meekly asking to borrow his car. Pauly was beside himself, smacking Dad across the head before tossing him the keys. Pauly drove a ragged brown Aspen with a permanent dent in the hood from some drunken brawl at Cindy's. They got in and set off on his first collection run. For this one, Dad stayed in the car. They traveled all around town, sometimes circling a store 3 or 4 times before Pauly had him slam on the brakes. Pauly would calmly get out, enter the bar or bakery, and Dad would hear a bell ringing, followed by cheerful greetings. Pauly would come out a few minutes later, tucking something into his pocket. He was always all smiles, until he got back in the car. Then he'd go stone-faced, his beady eyes devoid of any soul. Only once that day did a collection take long. It was their second-to-last stop, a bait-and-tackle shop that had just opened up. Pauly's face darkened when he saw the owner inside. "This gentleman," Pauly said, "is always short." He slammed the car door shut and walked in. Pauly wasn't tall, about 5 feet 4 inches, with a bit of a gut and the face of a century-old bulldog. But the store owner's face exploded in terror when he saw him. Pauly grinned that shark-tooth grin and walked him to the back. Dad noticed that Pauly flipped the close sign as he entered. 30 minutes passed before Pauly emerged from an alley, glancing around like a ghoul hiding from daylight. His knuckles were raw and throbbing, but he said nothing. "Nice enough guy," Pauly mumbled. "Shame his business ain't taking off," Dad noted. "Didn't see him come out of the back. I was helping him do some inventory. He took a bad fall. Told him to ice his leg," Pauly replied. "Deadpan. I'm a helpful guy. You know that, right, Frankie?" Dad just nodded. "Pull up to that butcher shop round the corner," Pauly added. "I'll buy you a hero." That was the end of that. The tackle shop shut down a few months later. Some of Pauly's associates came in and ransacked it, taking everything but the copper wiring. No one ever heard from the owner again. Dad eventually got his own car, a flashy red Vega. He was proud of that thing and enforced a strict rule: no carpets. I didn't get it at first, but then he told me the story. One night, Pauly called, friendly but strained voice. He needed a favor, just a ride, real quick. Dad agreed. He drove to a sleazy nightclub in Newark, pulled around back, and saw Pauly and his buddy, Sal Valentine, a.k.a. Waddles, due to his gout-ridden limp. Sal got in the front seat, drunk and reeking of cheap perfume. Meanwhile, Pauly was dragging something heavy and lumpy to the trunk. They made some small talk. Pauly said they needed to swing by the docks. While driving, Dad started hearing a thump from the trunk. Then another, louder. Pauly froze. Sal ignored it. "What's that noise?" Dad asked. "Potholes," Pauly muttered. Dad wasn't buying it. He pulled over. They were near Dock 55, where the Mariani family made problems disappear. Sal got out and popped the trunk. A muffled voice screamed from inside. "Pretty chatty for a carpet," Dad said. Sal silenced the voice with a solid punch, slammed the trunk shut. Dad stared Pauly down. "Does my father know you have Antonio Petriello in a carpet?" "It'd be better if he didn't," Pauly admitted. The rest was business as usual. the carpet got loaded into a container marked with a red X. In the morning, someone would ferry it out to sea. Paulie slipped Dad a fat envelope, and that was that. From that point on, Dad banned carpets from his car. Years later, he told me that Sal vanished not long after. The Petriello crew never did stop asking about Antonio, so it made sense to offer Sal up as a sacrifice. But sometimes things got weird. He picked up two guys for a heist. They were after a truck headed for the Natural History Museum. They figured it was loaded with treasures. Turns out it was packed with Egyptian artifacts, stone statues, death masks, and canopic jars. One of the guys stole a Bastet statue. From that night on, a black cat sat at his window every evening. He had nightmares of being dragged to the underworld. He went mad. Eventually, his friends found blood at his apartment window, but no body. The statue was gone too. I begged Dad for more stories, but he said that was enough for one night. I just came back from the store with a bottle of his favorite grappa. Maybe, just maybe, I'll get more tales out of him tonight. Story 15. For the record, I've never really told anyone this story. I come from the kind of family that would laugh in my face if I ever tried to explain what happened, so I kept it to myself for a long time. I should also add that I'm not super literate, so please excuse my grammar. I was about 9 or 10 years old, watching a movie with my dad and younger sister before bed, like we did almost every Friday night. Every night around the same time, Dad would send us to bed. We'd put on our pajamas, hop into bed, and wait for him to come up and say goodnight. He'd come upstairs, turn off our lights, and tuck us in. Sometimes it'd take 2 minutes, and sometimes I'd fall asleep with the light on before he came upstairs. That night, I got into bed facing the wall and pulled the covers up over my head like little kids do. Everything covered but my face. As I was lying there looking at the wall, a human-shaped shadow slowly walked into the room. From my perspective, it was a clear outline of a person from about the waist up. I distinctly saw the outline of an ear, and the silhouette moved with the subtle shifting and bobbing people have when they walk. It stood over me, not completely still, for maybe 15 or 20 seconds, and then walked out of the room just like it came in. I wasn't horrified so much as I was confused. After it left, I waited a few minutes before I got up and went to get my dad. He was downstairs sitting in his chair, finishing a bag of chips. I asked him if he had come into my room because I had seen something. He looked at me like it was the most ridiculous thing he'd ever heard, brushed me off, and told me to go back upstairs. Now, for him to walk up 3 flights of stairs and into my room, completely silently in an old house, and then walk back down the same way, would have been impossible. I was wide awake the whole time. I've thought about that night for 20 years, and to this day, I have no idea what happened or why the shadow was there. Maybe some of you have experienced something similar and can help make sense of it. Story 16. We moved out of the greenhouse not long after that incident. We didn't go far, though. We were still living in Vail, just on the other side of town. If you know Vail, Oregon, you know that's not all that far at all. We moved into a cute little white house behind the Dairy Queen. I'm not sure if it's still there. My room could best be described as a closed-off porch. It had big windows and a door that opened into the yard. Honestly, I could have snuck out whenever I wanted and no one would have known. My family didn't pay much attention to me.
This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy and features real testimonials.
This was our first time trying therapy, and honestly, it was long overdue. Looking back, we just wish we had started sooner.
Regain's qualified therapists help couples when they can't get there on their own.
We thought it was intimacy issues, but Andrea helped us uncover a deeper root cause we hadn't even realized was there.
Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. Regain, couples therapy that works.
Everything from clothing to household items are getting more expensive each day. American Giant is about keeping things simple and close to home. They aren't affected by tariffs because their products never leave the U.S. Support American-made, tariff-free clothing with American Giant. Get 20% off your first order when you use promo code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off when you use code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
Confused on where to start with weight loss medication? See the lowest prices available with or without insurance for Wegovy, Zepbound, and more at TryLifeMD.com. 95% of LifeMD patients said starting their weight loss journey was simple. Listen to Tara's story after losing 42 pounds.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. I had gone from 237 to 195. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
Get your free insurance benefits check in minutes right now at TryLifeMD.com. Nearly 96% of patients said they would recommend the LifeMD program to anyone who wants to lose weight. Get started right now at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
But that's not what this is about. At first, nothing weird happened in that house. I was thrilled. There didn't seem to be any ghosts. Bonus, no basement. It was peaceful for a while. I was still in grade school back then. And although I have stories about the school too, this one is just about the house. I wasn't hearing chains or seeing little girls in closets. I didn't even have a closet, so that helped. But peace never lasts for long. We had moved there in the summer, so we kids had all day to just play. It was nice until I saw them. My brothers, stepsister, and I were playing outside. Mom was inside watching TV and fixing us snacks and sweet tea. She swears she didn't see anything that day, and maybe I'd believe her if it weren't for the stories she's told us over the years. I love my mom, but she has this gift of seeing only what she wants to see. That day, she decided she didn't see a thing. We were playing when I heard a voice I didn't recognize. And to be fair, my mom and stepdad had a lot of friends coming and going. But I had a sinking feeling this wasn't one of them. I don't remember what the voice said, just that it was male. I could have brushed it off like my mom did, but then I looked toward where the voice came from. That was a mistake. Standing at the edge of the property, I saw a group of men. Some were native, others looked like settlers. The thing is, they were all see-through, transparent, ghosts. And to make matters worse, one of them saw me looking at them. I wanted to run, to scream, to hide. I wanted peace this time, not more ghosts. I closed my eyes and told myself they wouldn't be there when I opened them. But they were, and they were closer, much closer. I'd never been that close to a spirit before. I'd only ever spoken to Wyatt, and at the time, I didn't even know if he was still around. One of the settlers, a tall, scrawny man, was furious that a child could see him. He started yelling at me, screaming that I was a witch. And to be fair, now I am, but I sure wasn't back then. I wasn't even 10 years old. I started crying. My brothers and stepsister looked confused. They couldn't see what I could. To them, I probably seemed like I was having a meltdown. They told my mom I was being dramatic. Thinking I had a migraine, she called me into the house. I did get migraines back then, still do, but this wasn't one of them. The group followed me into the house. A native man was trying to calm the angry settler, and thankfully it worked. But now they knew I could see them, and I knew they wouldn't leave me alone. For days, one of them would show up and try to talk to me. I ignored them as best I could. My birthday was coming up, so I tried focusing on that instead. Then on my birthday, things came to a head. I was telling my mom how happy I was when one of them appeared, this time a native woman. I tried to tell my mom, but she insisted it was just my imagination. Eventually, I gave up and told her I had a migraine and wanted to lie down. Once I was alone, the native woman started talking to me. Here's the thing about ghosts. If they don't know they're dead, they usually don't mess with the living. But once they know they're dead, all bets are off. They can move things, speak in their native tongue, and affect the physical world. But this woman was kind. She didn't try to scare me. She didn't move anything. She simply wanted me to understand. When I told her I couldn't help, she nodded. "Young ones like you usually can't," she said. I asked what she meant. She told me others had this ability. Some tried to help, some used it for fun, and some just ignored it completely. She told me she wouldn't let the others bother me anymore. I might still see them, but they wouldn't try to talk to me again. I was so thankful, though I still sometimes walk through one by accident or woke up to one sitting at the foot of my bed talking quietly. I got used to it. Thanks to her, I finally began to accept what I was seeing. It's actually one of the better memories from my childhood, finally coming to grips with my ability. And now that I think of it, I'm not sure I ever thanked that woman. Maybe one day I'll go back and see if I can find her. She was the second spirit ever to be kind to me, after Wyatt.